Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is sort of an off-the-books type of show. I am not solo, as you might think. I have a very special guest with me, Ryan Thompson from the Gamer Parent Magic Hour podcast. He's also been on this podcast a few times now. Thanks for joining with me, Ryan.
Yeah, it's good to be back, John. It's been too long.
Yeah, the Nintendo
Show, that was my first step into the world of podcasting. I got addicted, and I had to find a way to do more podcasting.
Yeah, because you're a co-host on the Gamer Parent Magic Hour podcast. You also do like your own, where you host with a special guest. I noticed that you did like a different sort of spinoff, sort of, but still on the same feed.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. A friend came in town, and we just sat down and had a little talk.
Yeah,
midnight.
Yeah,
it's fun.
You
live
both,
podcast recording.
The one that I listened to most recently. Have you done another one since the Star Fox one?
No, but I need to.
Okay, yeah, it was a really good show, and you guys were very, very wrong about Star Fox, but it was a good listen.
Okay, so you didn't like Star Fox at all?
I liked Star Fox a lot.
You liked it a lot.
I thought it was tremendous. We don't have to get into Star Fox here. We're actually here to talk about Xenoblade Chronicles.
We are! Yes!
Mostly focusing on the first game, but you know, we'll probably touch on Xenoblade Chronicles X as we go through, just by, you know, by way of comparison. You know, we're just going to go where the conversation leads us.
So, that's right.
We're shooting from the hip here entirely. This is like a kitchen table conversation. So I wanted to just start by asking you, like, what was your first exposure to Xenoblade in general? Like, when did you first hear about it?
You know, this was my wife. She saw the game was releasing through GameStop. It was GameStop exclusive, mm-hmm. right, as I recall. And my wife picked up on that and said, oh, this sounds like something that we would enjoy. And it was actually her that decided to grab it.
Did you guys grab it at launch?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes, it was. I believe it was a pre-order, man. This is one of the last games we pre-ordered.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I also had this one pre-ordered, and you had to, because now the game goes for ridiculous prices.
If I were at all like capitalist or anything, I would be real smart and sell my physical and just download it.
Is it? Wait, did I miss the North American digital release for this thing?
Oh yeah, dude, it's on the Wii U.
No shit, that's amazing.
No crap. It's there. It's there, man. Yeah, and I've heard that, I haven't tried it out myself, but word is that the gamepad is supported as a controller as well, which would have been very handy for me to be able to use the gamepad as a controller, not just a screen, for Xenoblade Chronicles. Because,
yeah.
Man, that was how I beat the game, dude, was Xenoblade on the gamepad screen with a Wii, you know, Wii mode and the probe controller hooked up, and I'm staring at the little gamepad screen.
So you were playing on the gamepad screen with a Wii remote and a Pro controller hooked up to it.
There's a reason. We've talked about doing this little Xenoblade chat for how many years? Right? Like it's been a little over
a year now, yeah.
Yeah, so there's a reason it took so long to do this, because it took me forever to beat the game. If I couldn't have put it on the gamepad, I would have never beat it. It's just because it's just so big a game and so long.
Yeah, it is. Do you know your final hour count when you got to the end of it?
I think the playthrough was 80 hours.
Oh, nice. Nice and brisk.
And I know that can't be right. But I had restarted the game. I had put about 21 hours in and then restarted, because a lot of time passed between my first attempt.
And yeah, there's a number of things going on in this game. I'm sure we'll touch on a lot of them, that it doesn't lend itself very well to having broken up play sessions. You forget a lot about the battle system, about where you are and where you're going, and where things are in relationship to you and your position.
And it's not too friendly. Xenoblade wasn't too friendly about getting you on track sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, they do have the thing, like at the bottom of the screen, then they have like a little tracker that kind of pointed you in the direction you were supposed to go.
Right.
But if you haven't played in a while, you don't really know why you're going there and what you're supposed to do when you're there.
And then there'd be certain quests that wouldn't have that tracker, or certain parts of the game where it would just be blank, and you're, okay, where was I? What happened here?
I can't imagine trying to start the game after several months off, like in the middle of Aerith Sea. Because that would just be a nightmare to try to navigate through and remember where you're supposed to go. So did you dabble a lot in the side quests? Or just kind of mainline
No, I did. I was pretty good about doing all of the side quests that I came up on until probably about hour 60 or 70. And I said, you know what? There are just too many of them. Once you hit a place called the Nopon Village.
Nopon Village. That is very tough to navigate and try to figure out. Like, because you get these side quests that are like, go talk to this guy that gives you a character name. And you're like, all right, where the hell is he? And those are the sort of quests where it doesn't really point you in the right direction. It's kind of like, yeah, just find this Nopon. He might be pink, he might be blue, he might be purple, but go find him and talk to him. Good luck.
Yeah, so I was good up until about Nopon Village. And then you end up continuing to have to go back to Nopon Village almost through the rest of the game, as I recall. And yeah, I grew very tired of Nopon Village.
Yeah, because there's Nopons throughout the world, and invariably you'll come along a side quest. So I'm like, yeah, there's this guy in Nopon Village. Can you go give him something for me? And you're like, no, come on. I don't want to
go. Oh, that's right. The random dude's out on their, the Nopon's out on their adventure that you find.
Yeah.
Take it back to, I don't want to go back to a town again.
I mean, one thing that they do that's pretty friendly with all these side quests is that there are times when you get a lot of side quests that are given to you when you first enter an area. It's like, go kill this monster, and this monster. And once you do it, you don't have to go report back. Now, they do that RPG thing where sometimes you do have to go report back just to have a conversation, but I feel like a good 70 or 80% of the side quests, once you deliver the thing or kill the monster, it's done.
Yeah, you get that message that pops up. You gave these back to the guy you would have had to fast travel to and find him.
Right,
we did it for you. Thank you.
And there, as long as we're on the tangent of side quests, there are a couple of other really smart things that they do. Like, they use that whole like vision of the future mechanic that is also essential to battles. They use that to give you hints about your pickups. So if you find like a little collectible on the ground and it might be important later, it'll give you a flash of the future. It's like, oh, well, now that I have this many of that, I'll go bring it back to this person. So it kind of gives you that push toward, hey, don't get rid of that. You want to keep that.
And it marked them all, which was great too, in your inventory. So when you were selling at a vendor, you knew what not to sell because they had a little exclamation or some other symbol next to them.
Right, right.
Some really smart design choices in Xenoblade Chronicles to make such a huge game less daunting.
Indeed. My first...
But it was still such a huge game.
Oh, yeah. I think I clocked by the time I finished everything, and I tried to do as many side quests as I could, and I found all the landmarks and stuff. I think I clocked 140 hours. So, yeah, quite a bit of heft to this game. So I was first exposed to this game back in 2009 when Nintendo announced it at an E3, but only had images of it. And I think they might have had like a behind closed doors like press video, but there was no actual hands-on to it. And this was when it was called Monado, the Beginning of the World. And if you Google Monado, the Beginning of the World, you'll get a couple of screenshots from that E3 that they showed. And there's one in particular, it looks like it might be the Bionis Leg or the Gower Plains, where there's like the rocky land bridges suspended in midair and waterfalls and stuff. And from the beginning, you get this very naturalistic view of the world. But this game kind of went radio silent for probably almost a year, right up until the Japanese release, which I think was 2010. And I think it might have also been 2010 or 2011 in Europe, but of course here in North America, we had never gotten word of any sort of localization or release. Even after the European release, Nintendo was still dead silent on the release of this game. Until
I didn't follow any of this junk so closely back then as I do now, but I'm glad to hear that it's exactly the same as it is now, just as frustratingly silent and uncommunicative as it is now. Okay.
You know, the more they change, the more they stay the same. Exactly. But then there was that whole movement, and they called themselves Operation Rainfall. It started off as just like this little blog spot post, and they just kind of rallied people together and kind of gave them like a community to rally around the Western release of this game, but then also the other games that they were kind of trying to get localized were The Last Story and Pandora's Tower. And then after those, I kind of fell out of tracking what they were doing, but they kept on working to try to get other types of games localized across various systems, and they still exist. Operation Rainfall is still a thing, and I think they do more traditional gaming website things now, not just efforts to get more obscure Japanese games localized. But a lot of credit goes to them for putting together this community to show Nintendo that we really wanted these games to release in North America. And they did things like put together petitions, and they put together like form letters that you could print up and sign your name and mail to Nintendo, which I did. And yeah, it was just really cool to have this community around this game. And it made when we finally did get the release a lot more exciting, which the release was in April of 2012. So right as the Wii was, you know, on the most bare minimum of life support you could possibly think of, and a few months before the Wii U released. So this was kind of the game between Skyward Sword and the Wii U. This was the big game that took up a lot of my time. Also, The Last Story and Pandora's Tower a little bit, although I never really did finish that one. But when you think about Xenoblade, what are the first things that sort of pop into your head?
Expansive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Immersive. Confusing.
I think I know where you're going with this. And one of the first things that I think of along those same lines is that I remember moments, not necessarily story moments in the game, not necessarily moments where you're fighting a big boss or an enemy, but I remember things like entering Colony 9 for the first time and being greeted with this huge city with all these people walking around. Now, I remember coming out of Tephra Cave for the first time and getting this huge shot of the Mechanus standing there like this sort of faded ghost against the backdrop of the sky. Now, I remember being in Satoru Marsh for the first time and going from that day to the night cycle where all the trees start glowing, and going off the beaten path in Satoru Marsh and finding this little rundown castle with this lizard boss in it who was way too tough for me to beat at the time, but I tried like 3 or 4 times and couldn't quite kill him, and then I came back much later in the game and just totally wrecked him.
That's one of my favorite aspects of Xenoblade, is the scale of the monsters in the world that you just randomly run up on mm-hmm. in your playthrough, and they wreck you epically.
Yeah,
and then you return and you wreck them epically,
which is really satisfying. It's really nice to be able to just progress a little bit further, or a lot further as the case may be, and then come back later on and just destroy them.
So, taking down that giant bipedal, I don't remember his name, but he was the ape-like creature on Onguar Plain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It felt good, man. It felt good.
And they do this really interesting thing with the way that, I guess maybe it's the way they're placing the enemies, but even though there are definitely areas you can go to where the enemies are going to be much stronger than you, and they do this also in Xenoblade Chronicles X, it never wears down your desire to just kind of wander and find the different places and the different landmarks that you can go to. So even though you know you might die by going over there, just to see what's over there, it's worth it.
Right, and I you got to give it to the designers for the placement of enemies, because you can sneak past them. Like, it becomes a stealth game to a degree. Once mm-hmm. you really figure out the box that those enemies are gonna see you, and you go, okay, if I go right over here, I can just sneak along the edge of this cliff face, get around this guy, and then boom, I'm in this new area. You can just be an explorer. Like, I played a lot of... I'm playing Xenoblade X now. I'm on my second playthrough of Xenoblade X after about probably 12 to 20 hours in my first round. I have started over again.
Bold.
Because enough time passed uh-huh. that I forgot everything. But the same thing here. It's... okay, I'm going to sneak around the world. And Xenoblade X, I feel like, gives you even that added carrot on the stick of just being an explorer.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're planting these data probes in X that actually expand your sort of expanse into the world, your territory, how much ground you can cover, how quickly you can cover it.
Your influence, maybe. But yeah, it's a really cool mechanic that they use there, because it does give you that desire to, like, hey, it's just right over there. All I have to do is find it, and I can plant another probe. And it gives you this view on your map of maybe some other quests that might be in that area. And if you're trying to fill that map up 100%, like a crazy person, like I am, then it gives you that hint, like, okay, this hex, you need to beat a big boss. And this quest, there's an affinity quest that you're going to come across at some point, and that's going to fill this in. Cool stuff like that. I mean, one thing that they don't do in Xenoblade Chronicles X is it doesn't feel quite as rewarding for finding the landmarks or the secret areas.
Yeah.
You do get, like, the little text on the screen, like, hey, you found
I've only
area.
Found one, and it's just, like, vantage point, right? Or is there something else I haven't found yet? Because this one was just vantage point.
There's vantage points. I think there's also just general places of interest that you come across, and they don't make quite as big deal about it, whereas in Xenoblade Chronicles, it's you get the text on the screen, of course, but then that's how you're also farming just tons of experience and money, is just by finding these things. And also in Xenoblade Chronicles, you have that extra incentive to where you can try to fill in the map just by walking around and swimming across every square inch of a lake, or you can just find all of the landmarks and that auto-fills in your map. And once I figured that out, I was like, okay, well, I gotta find all these things because I want to fill in all of that map.
Yeah. That's right. The map is grayed out. You got the fog of war.
Mm-hmm.
And which you do still have in X, but the difference is all your probe sites are already laid out for you. You just don't see the topography of the land when you switch to topography view. I did, and I just found that out, like, this morning, that there was a...
Yeah.
Like, a topography view. I'm staring at the symbol map this entire time, like, oh, look, I haven't been there. I didn't know this existed. Okay. Yeah, yeah, still figuring stuff out in X for sure. And I think even after 80 hours to 100 hours, I still didn't figure everything out in Chronicles.
X is a very interesting game in terms of the way they designed it, because from top to bottom, everything about that game is just start doing things and you will figure it out as you go. There's really, I can't think of a single tutorial in the game. Whereas in Xenoblade Chronicles, you get a few tutorials about how to battle and how to put together a chain attack, that kind of thing. But in Xenoblade Chronicles X, everything from how you're moving around and planting probes, how you're fighting, things like when you get really deep into the game, like manufacturing custom weapons for your skells, putting augments onto your weapons to, you know, enhance your gravity attack and all that. Like, you can get really into the weeds here. And the game never puts you in that direction until, you know, you're getting into some of the post-game stuff and you're coming against enemies where it's incredibly beneficial to start customizing your weapons. So you can play through it from start to finish without ever getting into the stuff. But once you start tinkering with something like, you know, manufacturing a custom scale, then you can't help but get caught into all of these other things that you might not have even known were there unless you, like, went and started, like, dipping your toes into the water. The game X is just, from top to bottom, a game that wants you to just go and look for yourself.
Yeah. One of the messages that keeps popping up, because X is also connected more to the, I guess, to the internet, to the Miiverse, than, of course, Xenoblade Chronicles would be. One of the messages that keeps coming up over and over again, because, you know, the system is not maybe as real time as would be nice, but it keeps coming up on my screen. This game is unintuitive, and I love it. And it's true. It's nothing makes a whole lot of sense until you really dig deep and figure it out. I just figured out how to put augments in my weapons.
Oh yeah.
Last night. Like, oh, okay, I see this now. I can put these little things in, kind of like gems.
Yeah.
In Chronicles and on gems. John, did you ever figure out the gem making?
No,
technique?
Not really. No, I just kind of threw some stuff together and mashed some buttons and hope for the best.
So you had no strategy, because by the end of the game, I at least felt like I had a strategy, and I don't think it did anything, but, like, I'm going, okay, I'm just going to click on all the green colors, okay?
No idea. I
click on all the fives, see how many I could put together. No clue how, like, the morale of the characters and the affinity between characters worked in terms of making that better. Just sort of, I need to clear my inventory of some crap. Let's make some gems.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good way just to purge some stuff, that's for sure.
And you know, occasionally you'd get some things that helped you out, too.
Yeah, you know, you do get some beneficial stuff, like just increasing your HP or increasing your agility. Those are usually ones I used most of the time. It's just sort of stat augmenting gems onto the weapons. So speaking of characters, who did you have like a main party that you rolled with in battle?
You know, I'm one of those lame guys. Like, I kept my party. It was mainly Shulk,
mm-hmm.
Ryan, and Sharla.
Okay. I mean, it's a good balance.
I had an A team and a B team. You know, I my A team was Shulk, Ryan, and Sharla. My B was Ricky, Dunban, and Melia, who was Clara in Doctor Who.
Yep, sure was. Clara Oswald. Yeah.
I got really excited when I figured that out. I was like, honey, this is the same voice. I knew I recognized her from somewhere. Who was your team, John?
Through most
and
of
the... this whole episode should just be known, Spoiler City, right?
Oh,
like, we're probably going to go Spoiler City here, because there's potential to go Spoiler City right here, right now.
Yeah, we are absolutely into spoiler territory, because, you know, by the second half of the game, I was mainly rolling with Shulk, with Dunban, who does join up with your party. He's a character that you meet in the beginning. And, of course, Fiora, who dies, allegedly, but not really. And just as a side topic, even though I kind of had the idea that Fiora might be showing up again at some point, that was still such a cool reveal. To be like, hey, guess what? She's alive. Because all you do is, like, see her fly by. And like, oh, yep, there she is. And hopefully she'll be joining up back with the party again at some point, which she does.
Yeah, I was excited when Fiora came back.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way in which she comes back and the whole time she's with you, you're wondering, you know, what's the end here going to be?
Yeah, because they keep on pressing that point home that she might not have long to live. Which, you know, you recruit her in hour 60 and then 140 hours later, like, I'm going to die soon. Are you, though? Are you? Because I've been side questing it up.
Oh, now, here's I think, at least where I am right now in Xenoblade Chronicles X. So we're shooting from the hip. Here's where mm-hmm. my brain is going. I kind of miss the direction of the characters that existed in Xenoblade Chronicles.
Yeah.
Because, it's Chronicles X is the silent protagonist idea. And I'm not opposed to the silent protagonist. I like that in a lot of my games. But what made Xenoblade Chronicles, or one of the things that made Chronicles so memorable and such an experience, was that it had a really deep, crazy story to tell, and it used all of these characters to tell it in I thought, pretty good ways. Yes, the story was over the top.
In such a good way, though. God,
yeah.
It was just batshit nuts.
It was bombastic, to say the least.
And it built so well. It built from, like, hey, that dude, the metal-faced mech, just killed our friend. Let's go kill him back. And then there's a giant who lives in the head of this prison, who's on top of the big, you know, biological monster that you live on. And there's this arm that's been cut off and fallen to the ground. And there are these mechanical people that live there. Yeah, it's just crazy.
And those moments aren't happening in X yet. At least at Chapter 6. I feel like Chapter 5, okay, I finally had a moment where I stopped and said, oh, I was worried this game was never going to have any sense of urgency or any real plot twist. And it finally had a plot twist. I'm not going to spoil anything in X because that's still, you know, new enough.
Yeah.
But you probably know what I'm talking about. How far are you in X before we continue? You've gotten your scale, at least.
I finished the story. So
you finished it. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, the credits rolled. I'm not done with it yet. I'm still tinkering with a couple of things. I'm trying to build a custom mech, or I'm going to try to build a custom mech this month. But I'm kind of piecemealing. I'm taking a little bit slower now that some other games are coming out. I think I've completed 80% of the map, 80% of my survey.
You are a crazy person.
Yes, I absolutely am. Next month, I'm going to try to get up to 90. I'm going to try to get 100% of the map by the end of the year.
Wow. Good luck, because that seems very daunting.
A lot of it at this point is killing a lot of tyrants that are very tough, which is why I need the custom scale.
You know, John, I'm not buying any video games this year. Like, that was a thing. And I've faltered a little bit here and there. But now, like, going into a game like Xenoblade, it's really good. It's like, okay, I could not play another video game at all.
Yeah.
The rest of this year and probably be all right.
Yeah, it's that big. There's that much going on in that game.
But on to the characters. Like,
yes.
In Chronicles, the characters interacted, the interactions between the characters were so very important. And since everybody was fleshed out and the main character was so critical to the entire storyline, I'm not feeling like I have the same weight in X. Like, because Elma, who is a character in X, is pretty much the mouthpiece for your character.
Right.
And you pick, I guess you're going to shrug or you're going to nod here and there. I don't know if I get customization of your character is a thing, and it's maybe gives player agency, but in this style of game, I think I want, I don't think I need that. I think I want Shulk back, or give, you know, Shulk, or give female Shulk, whatever. If you want at least that option, customize, who cares? But I don't know. Do you like the silent protagonist approach? Do you feel like it was the right idea? Because I'm missing the character driven story of Chronicles in X. And maybe that changes. Does it change? Am I going to feel differently come 100 hours in X?
No. Sorry, you're probably not. I mean, mileage may vary. Maybe you're going to get a lot more excited about it, but I doubt it. The story is very much even keel throughout. And they introduce some weird characters, but...
Alvin and the Chipmunks, anybody?
So, to your point, I do like the silent protagonist. I don't think it's entirely right for this game or this franchise, I guess we can call it now, because they've already like dropped hints that like, hey, maybe we want to do another one of these. So I think at this point we might be looking at a franchise. And I think what people want from this franchise is that the really great word that you used, bombastic. They want like the just really crazy, weird, outrageous stuff going on that, you know, starts small and then builds up to this just outrageous story. And I can see why they didn't do that in X, because it is much more about exploring and creating this experience for yourself. But they're trying to do any sort of narrative delivery in the game through the conduit of Elma and Lynn. And there are other characters in the game, but because they want to give you that freedom to use anybody you want, they can never really have that much impact on what's going on. And while I don't think that's the be-all, end-all of what is going to make a game good or not, I think that in this series, it helps. It helps to have people to cling on to guide you through all of the zaniness that's happening.
Yeah.
So I would have preferred to have a Shulk in the game. I think I would have preferred to have probably some sections where there are different characters who are required to use. But I see why they did it. I see why they did it the way they did.
Can you switch characters in X?
No. No, not so that I can recall.
You can switch your class, so that would be like switching a character.
Yeah. Yeah, you can change up your class. It's going to change up the way you battle, but you're always going to be... Well, can we do a spoiler for a side quest?
I think that's safe. If you care about... If anybody cares about a side quest spoiler, just stop here.
It's not a story quest. It's not an affinity quest. It has nothing to do with the main narrative. What you can do at a certain point in the game is you meet this character who runs this sort of shady underground shop, and you have to meet him at specific locations, and you end up meeting him like down in like the depths of New LA at like 1 a.m. And he actually runs this shop where you can change the way you look. I won't say why you can change the way you look. That's a little too spoiler heavy, but you can actually change the design of your character. It's kind of like changing your character, I guess. Not really.
I haven't made it that far yet. I haven't made it to that quest, at least.
But I
know why, so I'm okay. This is something to look forward to.
It's buried pretty deep. There's a sequence of events that I'm not even actually sure how you trigger it. I just kind of came across him one time, and I talked to him. He was like, oh, meet me at this thing. And I was looking for him, and I ended up having to go into FAQ because I had no idea where he was talking about. But yeah.
These two games are both well played with a FAQ on hand at all times.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. Especially
and I didn't want to do that in X. I was trying real hard, especially with, I feel X directs you a bit better. That arrow is there more frequently, and your map shows a location more frequently. But it no.
I think that in X, having that FAQ is probably best used for things like finding items that you can farm off of enemies if you're going for augments, or if you're just super lost and need to, like, where is this location? Like, where is this landmark that I need to get to? That kind of thing. I wouldn't ever use a guide or an FAQ for just, like, regular progression throughout that game.
Yeah. Well, John, we're at, like, the half-hour mark, so I want to ask you, what's your favorite part about Chronicles? It could be, you know, anything. It is a system or a story part or just something in general. But favorite feature of Chronicles?
Well, we've talked a lot about my favorite feature already, and that's just exploring the world and moving throughout the world and finding all of those landmarks. That was really probably what I spent the most time in the game on, is just going through it and making sure that I had all of the maps filled up by finding those landmarks. But I'll pick a different feature, so we got something else to bridge into. I really like the battles in Xenoblade Chronicles, and it's probably one of the first times I played an RPG that wasn't a pretty strict turn-taking, like Final Fantasy-style battle, maybe with an active time bar, maybe more like Final Fantasy X, where it's strictly turn-taking. And to that point, I really didn't have an appreciation for a more active MMO-style battle system. It was very much like Final Fantasy XII is the example I go to a lot of times, because I didn't really like the battle system in that, because it was much more active than, say, a Final Fantasy X. But what Xenoblade did is it had these battles that were more active, but because of the way that they use cooldowns, it was kind of this hybridization between an active battle system, which is just a strict action RPG, and a turn-taking RPG that really worked for me. And I like putting together chains and tinkering with party members to get the best chains put together. Yeah, it was the battles for me were one of the big draws of the game for sure.
It probably took me 40 hours to figure that out, how to efficiently chain attacks together between the characters. And
I still don't know how to fully exploit the whole, like, vision of the future thing and using the correct attack to thwart what's going to happen. I still have no idea how some of that works.
And how often did you have to, like, switch up your characters because you needed to topple an enemy more frequently? So you'd play as Rhine or someone who can do an actual move to make this work.
Well, a lot of that went into my party construction, because a lot like you, throughout the early parts of the game, you're going with Shulk, Sharla, and Rhine. And it's a really well-balanced team, because you have your guy who's going to absorb all your damage, you have Shulk who's going to dish out a lot of damage because he's got those Monado skills, and you have Sharla who's going to heal you up and give you some stat buffs. Toward the middle of the game, I switched it up to the team I mentioned earlier, because Dunban can break, topple, and I think daze with specific arts that you set him up with just on his own. And Fiora is very similar. And I think Shulk, the only thing Shulk can't do on his own might be topple. But when I had a couple other characters rolling with that, I was just toppling everybody and using that mechanic throughout the entire game.
Nice. Yeah, I just would end up playing as Rhine quite a bit, because I needed to... Which one could he do? Could he actually do the toppling?
And Wild Down, was it?
Wild Down, yes. Wild Down!
So that, and it's Rhine time. And yeah, that's actually... You reminded me, you can actually play as different characters in that game. You're not stuck playing as Shulk.
No, and when you play as a different character, like, it fundamentally changes the way combat feels and the way you handle combat. And that's really kind of another cool thing that Chronicles did, is if you wanted to change it up, You could switch your characters and get an entirely different feel of the game. And the characters are all so varied and their skills are so varied.
Yeah.
I loved playing as Dunban for Blossom Dance. That three hit critical combo he could do. Even Hiropon Riki was a lot of fun when you started chaining together his weird moves that he could do.
Yeah, how the hell did you make him useful? Let's get into this.
I made Riki a tank. And I'm trying to recall, it's been long enough now that I've sort of forgotten it, but I made him a tank that would taunt the enemy toward him. He had a ton of HP by the time I was rolling with him. I was able to get his HP up real high, and he was just absorbing the hits, man. And then he could also, so not only I'm controlling the enemy with Riki, he can also do his happy dance and heal the party.
Okay.
He came in real handy in the shrine area that's in, I think, Aerith Sea, where you're taking basically the Klingon ritual of
the high Entia rite of shrine. Passage.
Yes, I used him through most of that area.
Yeah, the high Entia, the sort of nobility class of the game that, you know, guess what, also turn into these big monsters. Because of course they do.
Of course they do. So I wanted to, when I asked you your favorite thing, so my favorite aspect of Chronicles, and you brought up a moment in the game that made me think so much of it. Every night I'd stay up and I'd play this. I'd go to bed, my wife would be like, so, you know, what's going on in Xenoblade? Because she, you know, it's just too in-depth for her to really enjoy. So it ended up being a game that I played on my own, right? Mm-hmm. What? Xenoblade Chronicles, it did such a good job of, yes, this is a 120-hour game. You could play this for even more. I read people on Miiverse who played it for 200 hours. You probably could go longer than that, but it had such a good pacing. And if you sat with it for even an hour, you made significant progress. At least you felt like you did, because you were getting some kind of ridiculous cutscene every hour.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're getting something new to look at, someplace new to go. Even if you were just kind of tinkering in one particular area, there was always something else to go and find. And yeah, it had such a really great sense of forward momentum. And that has to do with just the world design and the narrative and the world construction of moving around throughout this big monster that once upon a time was fighting another monster. And that's all that happened in this universe.
Yeah, and just how well all of that was constructed. They were all, like, constructed around each other.
Mm-hmm.
At least it seems like it. You're looking at this red dot in the distance the entire game, and you know eventually you're going there. And you're pushed on towards that. It's like, oh, this is cool. I'm finally getting closer to this thing. And you think the game's over, man. Like, you think you're there, and then, oh, another 50 hours.
Yup.
But you never felt like you were dragging. I never felt like I was dragging in that game. And if I ever did, it was because I was stuck on side quests, and you could just say, okay, enough of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is like Xenoblade X again? And I, you know, I'm kind of doing the comparing to X because that's what I'm playing now. Xenoblade X has it all laid out in front of you. At least it feels like it. I don't know. Maybe again things change, but the world is already laid out in front of you. You can go anywhere already. The drive isn't so much the story; it's the explorations. It feels different.
Yeah, you know what it is? I'll put together this metaphor. Xenoblade Chronicles is kind of like going tubing and floating slowly down the river, and then it starts to pick up, and then you hit the rapids, and then you go over a waterfall, and things just ramp up so well. Whereas in Xenoblade Chronicles X, you are already at the bottom of the waterfall, and you are pointing your head up, and you're trying to take a drink.
It's a good metaphor. Because you are drowning in the scenery in Xenoblade X. Not to say I don't enjoy Xenoblade X. I'm having a blast, but it's like they did a great job showing off just how beautiful a Wii U game can be, because it is absolutely beautiful. One of the best looking games I've ever played, and I'm not playing on a PlayStation 4. I'm not playing on a high end computer, but X looks great.
Yeah.
It's the vistas are amazing. The world around you, everything is just wonderfully realized.
It doesn't get quite as outrageous. It doesn't get quite as fantastical with its environmental design as Xenoblade Chronicles on the Wii did. But they do have these moments in a couple of different continents. I don't know how far you've gotten yet.
When I went to Noctilum,
okay,
and I found myself yearning for Satori Marsh again.
Mm. There are a couple of places in Noctilum where there's like some poison marsh water, and there's a couple of cool little caves. But I think when you get to Sylveum and Caldros, you know, they kind of have their general aesthetics. You know, like Primordia is a very mountainous, and Noctilum is a forest, and Oblivia is a desert. And they all have like their own little, you know, sort of sci-fi fantasy flourishes. There's a few more of those in Caldros and Sylveum, but they do just kind of generally maintain their personality, their general personality throughout.
Do you watch Wayward Pines, John?
No, I've never watched that.
All right. So I won't go too deep in this, but this is what my wife and I were watching while I was, you know, a minute late to the show today. Wayward Pines is about humanity surviving in a fenced-in community, and they're all that's left. So I was just playing Xenoblade this morning,
so
going,
it's a
"Oh,
it's
this
a comedy
is...
then. This is a funny show, right?"
it's hilarious. It's hysterical. Check it out. It's a guaranteed winner of comedy of the year. But no, Xenoblade X. It's like, oh, this is Wayward Pines in space.
Do you want to say anything about the end of Xenoblade Chronicles?
All right, let's talk about the night we beat this game, right? So, yes. I tell you, this beating Xenoblade Chronicles is going to be a game completion I remember probably until I die, because a friend from a gaming forum from the forum Gamers with Jobs, and I, we're, you know, three and a half years late to finishing this game. It's 3.5 years later. It's 2015, late 2015. And we're typing back and forth on the forums and where we are. We're messaging on the Miiverse. It's like, I'm at this point in the game. And it's the, like 9 o'clock at night, and I type on the message board, I'm at the end of the game. I can feel it. This is the end. I'm fighting this boss that I'm 90% sure is the final boss. And my buddy writes back, I'm there too. So my friend and I beat this game literally within minutes of each other. Nice. It's taken us 3.5 years, and we finished it on the same night. Took the, I can't remember the name of the final guy down.
Neither can I.
Wow, he was pretty cool boss, but I can't remember his name. But I remember the battle, and I had to go back and farm. I started that battle at level 75, and I could not finish it. So I had to go back and farm up to like level 81, I think, is when I came back. And you know, that's great in JRPGs, and I hope that's something that just continues, is that the enemies don't necessarily scale, so that you can overpower yourself and you could just go in and destroy the game.
I'm kind of two minds about that sort of thing, because I do really like RPGs, and I do think it's rewarding that, you know, you put your time in, you play the game more, you should be significantly stronger based on, you know, the amount of time that you're putting into the game. But then there's also the school of thought that just dumping hours into the game doesn't actually make you better at it. It just kind of gives you better stats.
Gives you an edge, and, you know, some of us need an edge, John.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that it should change. I'm just saying, like, it's an interesting thing to think about in terms of game design. Like, Is there a way in an RPG that the player can become better rather than the character becoming better? I don't know that there is, because as the player, you're effectively selecting things from menus the whole game. How do you get better at that? But like in an action game, like a God of War or a Darksiders, that kind of thing, like you the player can get better. Or like in Bayonetta, to kind of keep it more Nintendo focused, you can get better at what you're doing. I don't know that it's possible in an RPG. That doesn't make it any better or worse of a game genre. It's just different.
I played Bayonetta on dad mode, man. I played Bayonetta on like easy automatic and just powered through it in 8 hours. So I have no legs to stand on in this conversation, other than I need to be able to power through games or I'll never finish them.
I did that in Bayonetta 2. Because I played Bayonetta 1 when it came out on Wii U, and then piggybacked right off of that into Bayonetta 2. By the time I was halfway through Bayonetta 2, I was like, this is generally not the type of game I play. I get why it's good. I get why people like it so much. I need to be done with it. I need to move on. So I was like, all right, easy mode. Let's just get through this.
Yeah. Yeah. That'll be me for Bayonetta 2 as well. And I enjoyed Bayonetta 1 because of its bombasticness.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not here to talk about Bayonetta.
No, we're here to talk about Xenoblade. So I remember.
So how did talk about your night, your day, or whenever you beat Xenoblade Chronicles?
I remember taking on the final boss, and first of all, like, one of the images that's burned into my mind is at the end there, where you're running through space, and it's going to give you that final narrative beat. You're like, what is going on here? And you pass like Saturn, you're running through the solar system. And then that's when you get to fight the final boss. And at that point, I had dumped, you know, 140 hours into the game, done a ton of side quests. I was crazy leveled up. He didn't give me much of a challenge, which, you know, I'll compare it to a different game genre again. It's kind of like saving your Magnum bullets in Resident Evil. You do it because maybe you don't want that final boss to be challenging. Like, you saved up your bullets at that point. The rest of the game has been challenging. Now it's just time to finish this guy off. So I didn't feel like I was cheated out of a really good boss fight just because, you know, it still took a little while, but I never really ended up taking all that much damage. But man, that ending where you get that, the final reveal, like what this world actually is. And
man, it was a revelation at the end of the game, because somehow I avoided the spoilers and you managed to avoid them too, obviously, mm-hmm. right? It was just like, holy crud, I'm walking through Earth's solar system. And I've got my daughter, because the first time I tried to play the game, kids were awake, whatever. They're robots fighting each other. I'm not worried about that.
Yeah. There's not going to be anything too objectionable. This game is not an episode of the Nintendo Show. This is fine for kids.
Well, she looks like that. And then we're talking about the planets, like Saturn. Like, yeah, daddy, what's the big giant robot doing in space? Like, honey, I don't know what's going on. I just know that we're walking by the planets and it's awesome.
They're making a new universe. That's what they're doing.
That's where I made a comment about, you know, that's what led me to make a comment about X a couple of nights ago on the Miiverse. And I was promptly shot down by somebody.
Some rando.
There's no way your just random thought about a video game is possibly correct because it's a different universe. But, you know, what if? I mean, spoilers.
It's a series that started with someone just creating a universe. Who's to say what's connected?
Right, but spoilers. Skip forward 45 seconds if you don't want spoilers. What if, just like in Mass Effect, the evidence of the destruction and recreation of the universe, what if there's something left behind and everybody else in the galaxy has figured out that the humans continue to recreate the universe because Shulk's story keeps happening in these different universes, just different versions? I don't know. Like I said, I'm that was just my random, like, you know, shower thought. What if that's what's happening? What if that's why they want to destroy these humans?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if they have the power just to kind of reset everything and reshape it with different laws of physics and stuff, yeah, I mean, that's probably something as a different civilization you might not want to happen.
Right? Right. Now, it's not spoiler time anymore, at least not for X. Now it's spoiler time for Xenoblade. John, right. There was a in Chronicles. Did you get anything wrong in the story? Like, was there something that you thought was for sure going to happen that ended up not happening?
No, I can't remember ever trying to make any sort of conjecture about what was going to happen in that game.
Oh, dude, I was for sure Alvis was evil. I was 1,000% sure that Alvis was going to betray everybody.
So he was kind of like just waiting for his opportunity to seize control for himself.
I thought Alvis was going to be the final boss. Mm. Not only that, I also thought Alvis was initially some weird alternate version of Shulk because he kind of looked a little like Shulk and kind of sounded a little like Shulk.
Yeah.
So I was expecting something to happen with that. And it didn't. I mean, I'm glad Alvis wasn't evil, ended up not being evil.
I mean, he had his shady moments. He was hanging out with Zanza there for a while.
Hanging out with the other, the big boobed, what's the Hyantia woman who betrayed the Hyantia?
No,
he was hanging out with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much anyone who was ever shady in the game, he would kind of hang out with every once in a while. But, you know, the game did have its share of traitors. I mean, Dixon ended up being just a huge dick.
God, what a huge jerk!
And no, I need to get some clarification on one point here, because I don't know what is going on. It's like Dixon goes through this monologue where he tells Shulk that Shulk doesn't have a soul of his own. They like found him as like a shell of a human being and they put the soul of the Monado into him, and that's why he is alive and has consciousness. But then they rip it out. How is Shulk alive again then? I don't Something totally passed right by me. I don't know what happened.
Is that the Japanese anime part of the story that we're... I'm not a big anime fan, so I'm is that like just something we're supposed to accept?
I guess. Maybe.
Just, oh, no. It was very weird. Yeah, like we took his soul out. Oh, but hey, he's finding it. Or maybe it just... His spark... Maybe, was just enough. Maybe he had developed his own soul.
Yeah, it could be. Maybe he was lying. Maybe it's like the whole Final Fantasy VII Cloud is a clone of Sephiroth kind of thing, where they keep on telling him, you're a clone of Sephiroth, and then further in the story, like, no, you're not. Never mind. That whole thing that we were preaching about before, no, it's not true.
It's been long enough, man. Since Final Fantasy VII, I've forgotten how that whole story thread went down.
It makes even less sense than Xenoblade. It's absurd.
I remember Cloud like crying on a bed, you know, shaking his pixelated, spiky hair.
Man, and his huge forearms.
The soul thing, the Monado souls thing. I you know, it's what you just—you don't have to get it. You just sort of sit back. If you try really hard to get it, you can no longer enjoy it at all, right? Like, you sort of sit back, let it happen. But you know, Dixon, you kind of saw it coming. At least I kind of saw it. It was pretty obvious that one time he's like hiding behind a tree, like, and he just chuckles to himself and you hear all his inward thoughts. They weren't trying to hide that he was going to eventually betray Shulk and company. And who was the name of the guy at the beginning that wanted the power of the Monado for himself?
Oh, Mumkar.
Mumka, yeah. I love that they, you know, the same voice was obviously the voice of that first big Mechon that you fight, you know, the first faced one. It's obvious his voice.
Yeah, the claw hands, yeah.
And I love that they didn't tell you that. You just are, as the player, you're obviously going to be smart enough to figure it out and then start to play through your mind, like, well, how do they do this? Like, what's happening here? Is he in there? Is it just his brain? Did they take his personality?
Yeah. Yeah, and I do like how they leave a lot of those things open to speculation at the beginning. You know, they eventually wrap things up. But you know, going back to the point about, you know, maybe there is no answer to why Shulk is alive again and maybe he does have his own soul kind of thing. It might be those types of things, those sort of plot beats, they time really well to where you can just sit back. It's like, sure, whatever. Yes, alternate universe running by Saturn. Great. Everything is fine here. Because they build it so well from being this, you know, fantasy story in a fantastic world to just being absurdity. All right, what else? What else do we want to hit here?
I'm just thinking about Xenoblade and thinking about if I should go do a new game plus here.
I tried for a little bit, and it's cool because you can do that new game plus. That's a good point to hit, and you do carry over your levels and your stats and your equipment. You carry that over as well, and then also you unlock a couple of weapons. Shulk can have a couple of different Monados, and I'm not super sure what the difference between all of them is, but they got a cool little art style. And I tinkered with a new game plus for a few minutes. I started going through Colony 9 and with Rhine and Shulk and early game Fiora, who is actually, it's a different character build. Like when you start a new game plus, early game Fiora has the same level that she was at when she died in that early game. So I was being a crazy person again, and I was going around finding high level enemies to beat up in Colony 9, which Shulk and Rhine were strong enough to beat, but Fiora was way under level. And I started leveling.
Just dropping her one hit.
Yeah, she was dying quite often, but she was still gaining experience. So I was leveling up early game Fiora, who was going to die anyway. There's no point in doing it. But, again, crazy person. I don't know why I do these things.
Now, new game plus, I've understood, is sort of where you can maybe get into those affinity story beats a bit more.
It depends. I guess it depends on how much you're mixing up your party and how much you are willing to put into the game before you finish it off. Because I actually, in my first run of the game, I maxed out affinity with everybody except for Ricky. Everyone.
You are a crazy man.
Right.
How did you do that? Like, that's something I feel that X does significantly better than Chronicles did, is these affinity missions. That tells you exactly who you need for them when you find them, what level you need to be, what the prerequisites are.
Yeah.
I was always disappointed to come up on one of the affinity points in Chronicles and be told, no, requirements not met, come back again later. And so I probably could count on both hands how many of those affinity scenes I saw throughout my playthrough. And I could YouTube, I'm sure. It's just not the same.
Right.
It's not the same.
Right. There's this sneaky little mechanic in the game that they never tell you about. So, you know, all those collectibles that you find lying around.
Mm-hmm.
You can have one character gift them to another. And it's like consuming a potion or something, which thankfully that's something really cool about this game. There are no consumable items. When the battle is over, everyone recharges. And it's always funny to me when, you know, Wes is on the show and he's talking about something like The Witcher 3 and how he, you know, can only carry so many potions. Like, what, you have a game that uses consumable items? How archaic. My goodness, there are items that you carry around that restore your HP. It doesn't just do it on its own, and then later on they're totally useless to you because your HP has way outgrown the amount that it can restore. Like, it's just baffling to me. But you can use these collectibles as consumable items, gifting from one character to another. And if you find an item that one character really likes and you gift it to them, the affinity grows between those two characters. So by the
mind blown.
Yeah. So by the end of the game, you have all of these collectibles built up. You look up an FAQ. It's like, well, now Melia really likes this type of flower. Okay, Shulk, Melia, just start gifting. And it takes a couple minutes. And there were a couple of times where I had to go item hunting for a little bit, which was a bummer. But yeah, that's how I maxed out affinity. I just started distributing these collectibles.
It's, you know, it says a lot about the depth of a game when you can have completed it.
Yeah.
And I completed it December 14th, 2015. So here we are, 7 months later, and I am learning something totally new I could have done to have made my experience even larger.
So I was actually on, about a year ago now, I was on the This Nintendo Life podcast with a couple of friends of the show, and the host of the show was telling me about how we were talking about Xenoblade, because I guess we were talking about Xenoblade Chronicles X or something. I can't remember how the conversation got led this way, but he was talking about how he wanted to fill in all the maps, and he was like swimming through every square inch of the Aerith Sea in order to fill in all of the map. And it hurt me to say it, but I was like, oh, you know, you could have just found all the landmarks and it autofills the entire map, right? So there are things in this game that they don't tell you that really enhance the experience, so you're not spending 20 hours swimming.
Which you could have done. You really could have done it. I remember one morning I had gotten up real early, and I think I just spent an hour swimming across the entire expanse of something, but just because I was curious.
Oh,
just because I was curious. Can I actually go all the way over there? And you know what? You can actually go there. And that was amazing on the Wii.
Yeah.
I'll
fully admit to diving off of the platform in the Machina Forest and swimming directly for that waterfall.
And, yep, nice.
And sometimes it feels like you're going nowhere, but you eventually get to the waterfall. And I think you might get a landmark for that, but I'm not entirely sure. I mean, they reward you with something.
I feel like that was maybe a secret location even.
Yeah, maybe.
I remember pinging something right by that waterfall. I'm recalling that. That was just a memorable game, man. Like, because of its size, maybe because of its bombasticness, but it's just such a memorable title, and I'm so glad we got it.
Yeah, I think that everything just meshed together really well, from the world design to the characters to the battles. Like, and it's seems to be something that Monolith is very good at, just taking all of these different elements and building something that's one really cohesive package that turns out to be a really great experience.
I think it bodes well for Zelda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we learned at E3 that Monolith is helping with some sort of development.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. That'll be another game that I just focus years on that and not spend any other money.
Yeah, and that's going to be the game. That's going to be it. Because,
yeah.
Because I don't know if we don't have to get too deep into Zelda here, but what I see in Zelda reminds me a lot of what we saw in Xenoblade and Xenoblade Chronicles X. Maybe not from like a narrative standpoint or from a standpoint of the world design. Like it's not quite as sci-fi or heavily fantasy driven, but just the way that you're going through the world and how they kind of direct you by not directing you and just collecting things and using those as tools. Yeah, I see a lot of Xenoblade in Breath of the Wild. I almost called it Call of the Wild.
Call of the Wild. That'd be something. A Zelda based on a 19th century novel? I'm probably totally wrong. I don't know when that novel was released. I just remember having to read it in like middle school.
Do you require your students to do summer reading?
No.
Oh, don't.
Oh, we're elementary school. They just go home and play.
Oh no, kid. You absolutely should then. Do it.
Go play. Oh man, I John, really, I thank you for just making a random space for us to talk about Xenoblade.
Oh yeah, it's cathartic. Because well, one last topic before we close it out here. How do you think this game is going to be remembered? What's the legacy of Xenoblade Chronicles?
That's a really good question. I think Xenoblade Chronicles will be the physical copies are already tough to find, so it's going to become one of those games that is sought after by collectors for you know, the, I guess, collecting purposes. But I think I'm not making any sense. This would have been a really good question to like have notes on and have really thought it out well. The legacy of Xenoblade Chronicles. I said this on a recent episode of the Magic Hour, so I'll say it again here. Xenoblade is a series that takes some of the things that I like the most from JRPGs, amplifies them, and added some new ideas in to streamline the experience, such as the quick collecting of items as you're going off about your regular missions. You're collecting a ton of things, so when you come to a side quest, you've already got everything you need. Like, oh, here, I'm already done. Bam. I think Xenoblade took it. From Xenoblade will move JRPGs to a, even though they're going to still be huge and expansive, they're going to have these, is the word quality of life? Is that the phrase we should use here? Quality of life improvements to the gameplay so that you can have the huge expansive game, it not be excessively grindy. I think Xenoblade has sort of, it set a standard for what's to come after it. I'm going to compare every JRPG that I play to Xenoblade Chronicles from this point on. So for those that play Xenoblade Chronicles, it's going to be the benchmark from here on out. Like, Final Fantasy 15 looks great, but I don't feel like I need to play another Final Fantasy game at this point because I have Xenoblade.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think the way people are going to remember this game is as a bold step forward for JRPGs, against which other JRPGs will model themselves and will be compared to. Because, like you were saying, it amplifies the really great things about JRPGs just from the weirdness to the expansiveness and to the direction that it gives you just to go look around in the world. And at the same time, it minimalizes the things that make JRPGs less accessible. Things like relentless grinding, like you would see in a Dragon Quest game, and things like all of the fetch quests that require you to go back and forth talking to people. It does its best to minimalize all that as well, while keeping them So I think this is going to be a game that at some point will probably be regarded as a modern masterpiece. Like this is a game that was bigger than the hardware that was on. It was a game that was bigger than the genre that it was in. It's truly a modern day classic.
And, you know, we had some Xenoblade Chronicles, and then shortly after that, you know, Bravely Default brought in some interesting things as well, mm-hmm. to the JRPG table.
Yeah.
This fast-forwarding through your battles in a more traditional, Bravely Default, obviously a more traditional menu-based RPG battle system. But that brought in some good quality of life improvements too, so.
I mean, and Bravely Second does some really smart things with traditional JRPG battles because of the way that you can... Have you played it?
I haven't.
So what Bravely Second does is it allows you to chain battles together. Like you win a battle, it says, hey, you just want to fight another one, and you can press...
And that exists in the demo.
Yes.
And it was really cool. Like you can go for more, you can go for bonus experience, bonus items, bonus money. You keep going again. Like, mm-hmm. okay, it's cool.
But you know, at a certain point, you can absolutely just break the game by doing that, which is fun. And it's cool that you can do it. I mean, that's just saving your Magnum bullets again. But yeah, this series from Monolith, is a bold step forward for JRPGs. And it's funny that Monolith is a lot of people who used to work at Square Enix. And then you got some other people at Square Enix who are doing their thing with Bravely Default and that series, which I hope also continues. So yeah, it's a pretty exciting time for JRPGs. And just to kind of continue this tangent, then you got people like Atlus, who seem to be taking more of a step forward into the limelight, even though they've been around for quite some time. It seems that people are paying more attention to the things that they're doing. And they're doing some interesting things with JRPGs, with series like Persona and Tokyo Mirage Sessions, which just came out on Wii U.
I mean, I could talk all night on just like my love of JRPGs. So I won't, because it's our bedtime. We have children.
Well, you just want to do a quick hour on Chrono Trigger? Because that game's turning 21 next month.
Man, I would need to replay it. That's actually, I think, Chrono Trigger is one of the first games that, you know, I emulated.
Oh, yeah?
Because I didn't play on Super Nintendo. I didn't have a Super Nintendo. And my emulation day started in high school. I discovered the wild, crazy, amazing world of emulation. And Chrono Trigger, I just randomly downloaded a ton of, like, Nintendo and Super Nintendo games, because why not? So my first JRPG was, I think, Final Fantasy VII, and that was the first time playing a game that could be that big and that expansive, and it took so long. I sunk 120 hours in it, and that's the game I like tried to get everything, beat all of the big weapons in. Mm-hmm. And I get an emulation, and I'm like, oh, there are Final Fantasies on Super Nintendo? Cool, okay, I didn't know that. All right. A whole world opened up, and I stumbled on the Chrono Trigger, and that's the first game I played to completion on emulation, and we could go on about how great that game is.
Indeed we could, but we shouldn't,
and you know we could, but I will seg that back into Xenoblade. Being able to control time, another cool thing click of a button, right? Another cool mechanic.
Yes,
you need, you've got an enemy that only appears at a certain time of day. Let's just, you know, just change the time. Just change the time.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, you know, from a narrative perspective, because Shulk can also see into the future, which you didn't really touch on in the battle system. I don't really have too much to say about it. It's just you get a glimpse of the future, and it allows you to try to stop them by pulling off a particular move or art or skill.
And even at the end of the game, I didn't know which color meant what to use to deflect it.
I have no idea.
Oh, all right. What was your... I keep coming up with new things for us to talk about, John. We could be here till midnight. Did you have any battles that railroaded you for a long time that almost resulted in rage quit?
I think the first time... No, it wasn't the first time I fought Zord. I think it was actually the first time that you fight Metal Face in Gower Plains, or you have to run up to the top of that platform. He was kind of giving me a hard time for a little bit. And I think that was probably where I first figured out the whole toppling system. Because, yeah, he was getting pretty rough.
Was that in the Aether Mines?
No, I think this was just before the Aether Mines. This is where you fight Metal Face in Gower Plains.
Okay.
In the second era, you've already crossed the bridge. I think that I'm pretty sure that battle is early on in the game. I might have to replay this. My memory's getting fuzzy.
I'm just trying to remember if you fought him. I thought the first time you fought a Metal Face was in the mines.
You fight Zord in the mines for sure.
All right, so that was okay. That was where I restarted the game.
Oh yeah,
I mean, I got stuck on him, and I didn't. I was an idiot. I didn't realize that you could just walk away after you died.
Oh yeah,
I thought you were just. I was stuck in that battle. I'm underleveled. I'm 12 hours in. Okay, rage quit.
I mean, that's one of the other really friendly things that they did in this game, like minimizing the nuisances of a JRPG. You don't have things like save points. You can save anywhere. When you die in a battle, you just kind of respawn at the beginning of that fight, or you know, a little distance away from it. You're never set back very far, which I think further encourages you to go out and explore, and both in this game and in X, because the risk for exploring is never so great that you wouldn't do it. You would risk running by a really powerful enemy because maybe he'll see you, maybe he won't. If he doesn't see you, cool. If he does see you and you die, all right, that's a bummer. I'll respawn.
Yeah. Yeah. If I had only realized that, at least, I don't know what was going on. I'll just blame it on the children. I had baby brain my first playthrough or something, because when you respawn after that battle in the Aether Mines, the Zord is right in front of you. And I guess I never turned around. I always just walk forward and get caught in the battle again. But
I mean, that's typically how games work.
Yeah.
You know?
I was just stuck in that way of thinking. I was stuck in traditional mechanical thinking. I didn't anticipate to be able to get out of that situation. So
I mean, it's almost like Donkey Kong Country when, you know, in almost every level, first thing you want to do, you should be running right, you want to run left. Because there might be a one-up over there. And you just kind of have to retrain the way your brain deciphers video games. Because you're taught to play one way for so long, and then something does something different, and you start to wonder why more games haven't done it that way.
Mm-hmm. But I think that there's one battle that towards the end made me want to quit. I don't remember the name of the boss. Like, again, it's like I've just forgotten all these names, but it was a boss that spawned two, like, orb additional robot enemies that would shield.
Huh. I don't remember that one.
He was a huge Metal Face. Was he the gold? Not the gold Mekon. Oh, who was it? Yeah, not Yaldabaoth. Now I'm looking for this boss. I cannot remember his name. I'm sure if I type Xenoblade boss battles, he'll show up right away. He was terrible. Boss guide.
I'll stall for some time here. You know what,
yeah,
boss? The other boss that held me up for a while was the Lady Hyentia. When you actually enter the Bionis, you're the Bionis interior, and you have to fight her, and she's in that area where, you know, it's very much organic because you're in the inside of this thing, and there are a couple of like little poisonous pools in there as well, and you essentially have to use Melia in that boss battle because the only way you're damaging her is with ether damage. And for a while, I kept on trying to plow through that boss the way I had plowed through other bosses to the game, but they made it so she just couldn't do it.
Oh, I don't remember that battle. Man, this game was so long that I've forgotten parts of it.
Yep.
Eagle. Is that his name? Is that a boss?
Eggle? Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the Mekons. Not like the brainless robots, but one of like the more humanoid ones. Yeah?
Was that one the...
There's just so many characters. There's so much going on in this game.
Like, I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the list of bosses and going, holy crud, dude, there was a dragon.
There was a dragon.
There was a dragon, like, out of nowhere. In the, oh, what was that part? It was, I don't remember the name of the area. Like, all right, so like, we sound like, I sound like an idiot now. This game was just so big, and there were so many different areas.
We're going to figure this out. What did the area look like?
It was like a, I almost want to say it was like a, almost, it was almost like a tower, and there were tons of levels, and you went up through like teleporters, and you had to get locks.
It's not the High Entia tomb, is it?
Is it? Yes, right?
No. Or was it Alchemoth after Alchemoth got destroyed by Telethia?
Prison Island?
Oh,
is it, no,
Prison Island.
Isn't it like Prison Island or something you can go into?
I know exactly the guy you're talking about now. Yeah, there was a dragon because eventually you go back to Prison Island and you're actually able to enter it. And then there's a tower you have to work your way up. Yeah.
That's it.
I wonder.
I think that was the dragon guy.
Before you kill Zanza, maybe.
I think so. I can't find the name of the boss that threw me for a loop. It was a really hard battle. I remember that. And I can't figure it out. I'm gonna have to just replay the stupid game.
We're gonna have to do it all over again.
You know what? Maybe we shouldn't replay it because if there's a game that I'd love a remaster of, I'm not really for the sort of wanton remastering of games that we're seeing lately.
Oh no, it's great, dude. Let's just put every game on every system forever. It'd be awesome.
I would buy Xenoblade Chronicles remastered.
Yeah, me too.
To have this in high definition, I mean, I think that's really all I want is I just want it in high def. You don't have to do anything super crazy with it.
Mm-hmm.
I just like to see high definition Xenoblade Chronicles, and I could probably get that through like the Dolphin emulator, but I'm not going to spend the time to make that work. I just put it on the NX.
Yeah. See, and there are certain games like Xenoblade where it came out and we're fully into the era of HD games and it wasn't HD. So it would be nice to see that in 1080p running at 60 frames per second, all the bells and whistles, you know. And there are other games where, you know, enough time has passed. Like the N64 was 15 years ago at this point, almost 20 years ago at this point. I'm okay with getting remakes of games like Ocarina of Time, Majora's Mask.
Right.
Twilight Princess, as long as we're on this tangent, it's, if I didn't love that game as much as I did, I might be a little bit against it because it came out in 2006. So it's not like it was out in the heyday of HD games, but it's still cool to see that game in HD.
But like, I tried to play Twilight Princess and wasn't able to because of how grainy it was when I played it again, because I started playing it during the heyday of high definition gaming.
Right. Right.
So going backwards, and it's not even that, it has to be high def. I mean, I played Xenoblade and I loved it and I appreciated the art style and I thought it did amazing things on the Wii, but it made my head hurt. Like, physically, it made my head hurt. And that's how I am getting older. My poor eyes, they can't handle they can't handle all these pixels. Like,
I mean, it does make a difference. You know, and as much as some of us rail about, you know, graphics not being important, story not being important, gameplay is all that matters. You know, if you want to be reductionist about it, I would probably come down to the side that gameplay is the only thing that matters. But, you know, how a game looks, how a game performs, a narrative to a point makes a difference because it can carry you through a game. It can make it a more engaging experience. And and there absolutely is a difference between, you know, a game that is running at 480 progressive scan and a game that's running at 1080p. There is a tangible difference. Doesn't necessarily make it more playable, but it makes it more pleasant.
Yeah, pleasant. I'd agree with that. I listened to a podcast called The Lapsed Gamer Show. They're a fellas out of the UK, and I outside of Nintendo, I consider myself to be kind of a lapsed gamer. I don't have time to keep up on it as much as I might like to. Mm-hmm. But when I hear the calls for, say, a Red Dead Redemption remaster, I'm playing Red Dead Redemption on the PlayStation 3 in fits and spurts, and it's like it plays fine.
I mean, it's already in HD.
It looks fine. Yeah, it looks fine. I mean, sure, we could add some graphical fidelity, maybe increase draw distance a little bit, but it has such a cohesive art style, and it's this fully realized world, and it doesn't really need it. Isn't there something else we could spend time remastering? Like, let's remaster Grand Theft Auto Vice City. You know, let's go back farther. Let's remaster the original San Andreas. I don't know. Let's just remaster Xenoblade Chronicles.
There's somebody sitting in a boardroom wearing a really smug suit saying, like, making decisions about, like, oh, well, you know, if we remaster this one, it's minimal work and we get a higher investment or higher return on our investment. Like,
I don't want to bash what people like, and it's a great. I'm happy for anybody who's getting something that they want, truly. But I just played Bioshock 2 on PC at the beginning of 2016, and that's a game that doesn't need a remaster.
I wonder. Here's an interesting side topic. What if we're getting to a point where, with things like remasters, which I think people commonly refer to them as HD remasters, even though some of these games were already in HD. What if we're getting to the point where remasters on more current systems end up becoming more commonplace, not because it's some sort of cash grab, but with things like incremental system upgrades like we're seeing with the Sony and Microsoft systems? What if that's becoming more commonplace to where games are not something that live and die on the system that they were made for? I wonder if maybe digital distribution will kind of help alleviate the sort of slimy commercialism that it seems like. But I think there is something beneficial to games being something like an actual piece of software being something that transcends the hardware that it was made for.
Yeah. That is a boy. John, we should just write a couple of our side topics down.
Because I mean, like, isn't it better for us as gamers to have games always accessible, so that I'm not busting out the N64 and blowing in the cartridges, which is something you should never do, in order to try to get it to work?
There's a reason I'm going to spend money on an NES Mini, and it's so I can have the nice sampler pack of Nintendo games and not have to go through the hassle of finding a Nintendo system that actually works, or buying a hodgepodge of games here and there on the virtual console. But I think it would be nice if, okay, you bought, and maybe with these iterations, the more iterative consoles, maybe we'll get to that point. Okay, you have purchased Halo 6 on the Xbox One. All right, so on the Xbox One S, if you buy the Xbox One S2 or the Xbox One Escalade or whatever we're going to call it in the future, your purchase carries over, but the one on the Xbox Escalade is going to be the shinier version.
Yeah.
Kind of like, I guess, on your iOS devices. And I don't know if you're an iPhone guy, John.
I do own an
Android,
iPhone. Yeah.
But even on Android, the marketplace, the apps, for the most part, what you purchased on your third-gen iPhone is going to work on your sixth-gen iPhone.
Yeah.
Without having to purchase it again. And, I mean, I don't know. I think we'll see. I don't know. I would imagine we'd probably still see upgrade fees, because there's probably a lot of money involved in this, and unless we want to go down the route of in-app purchases in all of our games, which
hey, yeah.
Xenoblade Chronicles, spend 10 cents to fast travel.
Oh my god. Don't say that too loud, they'll hear you.
Yeah, it's too late. It's been said.
I can edit it out. I can fix this.
Yes, yes, we can fix what we've done.
Dark timeline.
You can change the future.
So, shoot, I was going to say something. Now I don't remember what it was. No, it wasn't anything about the NES Mini, which looks cool. Looks like a cool little novelty. It was... Oh, I do hope that we get to a point that the value of a game as art overcomes the value of companies reselling games over and over again. I hope it becomes more valuable to have these always accessible than it would be just to repackage and resell. And maybe that's like a utopian view of the future. I mean, we still do get Madden games every year when you know they're perfectly capable of sending out an update. Like, hey, update your roster and the stats, add some new players. Here's Madden 26. It's you buy one Madden game for whatever system you have, and then you just update it every year with the new stuff. They can do it, of course, and maybe they'd be able to charge a nominal fee. Like, hey, $10 for the update. And there you go. But, you know, they end up making them every year. I mean, I assume. Am I wrong? Do they stop making Madden games?
They haven't stopped making them yet, as far as I know. I haven't played a Madden since the Super Nintendo.
Neither have I.
And there, you know, there are people out there still updating Tecmo Super Bowl with new rosters. So it's doable.
Good for them.
And, you know, Nintendo is certainly a company that's guilty of this repackaging, too. I mean, how many copies of Super Mario Brothers have I bought? How many times have I purchased?
It's true.
You know, these NES games over and over again.
And I think what everyone wants, you know, when they talk about a virtual console and cross-buy, and I imagine there's going to be some conversation around this NES Mini. What people want is they want an accessible digital library of legacy games. And Virtual Console, you know, back in 2006, seemed like it'd be a really great solution. And in many ways it has. It's made a lot of games more accessible to people that have never played them before. But it's never become that curated museum of legacy games. I think a lot of that goes back to games, especially during the 8 and the 16-bit eras, being viewed as these disposable consumable products rather than something that might want to be revisited one day. But anyway, we've digressed.
We really digressed. We're getting like into game preservation and value of games historically and culturally. Xenoblade, man, it brings out, it's deep.
Yeah.
That's just the point. Xenoblade gets deep.
When you talk about art, this is the topics that are going to come up.
And maybe this should be our last point. We're speaking about art. Did you play Xenoblade with Japanese voices or the English voiceovers?
I stuck with the default British voice acting.
I hated it at first, man.
Yeah.
I hated it. And I grew to love it. Those first few hours, this is the worst voice acting I've ever heard. By hour 20, it's like, oh, it's charming.
But yeah, by hour 20, like, yeah, it is Rhyme Time. Absolutely. It is.
Yep. Yep. It's in my second playthrough, because I put about that 20 hours in the first. The second playthrough, the voices didn't bother me at all. I was like, oh, okay, I'm cool with this.
Yeah,
I'm totally cool with it now. When my wife, for the brief time my wife played it, she kept the Japanese on. She also keeps the Japanese on in like Soul Calibur games too.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
I can see that, because you're executing a lot of the same moves over and over again.
Yeah,
but anyway,
why are they like Pokemon calling out there?
Should we talk about Pokemon Go for a half hour?
Oh
no, you're right. You're right.
How much time you got, John?
We should pull the plug on this.
Just yes or no, are you playing?
When it lets me. The game's not a crashy, buggy mess.
And unfortunately, it's a crashy, buggy mess when you're actually doing something of note.
Yep.
I defeated a gym leader yesterday.
Nice.
When did the game crash? Just as I'm taking the gym.
Wonderful.
It's like, are you serious? It has definitely bordered on frustrating enough to almost push me off the edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. But then we went to a park, man. We went to a park, the kids and I, and there are six other groups in this on this playground that has three poke stops in range of the playground, and everybody is just playing it, and we're talking. I've talked to more humans in the last 4 days than I think I have in 4 years. It's just random people.
It is very cool how it's become this cultural touchstone. Like, hey, you know, it's just something we're all doing, so it's cool.
Yeah. But
before we get too deep into Pokemon Go, we'll pull the plug on this one.
Yes, just we've shot from the hip. We've unloaded our ammunition probably more than once.
So yeah, this was good. It was good to revisit this game and talk about it with you.
Yeah, likewise.
So
I'm, thanks, John. Again,
yeah, thanks for coming on here. I'm probably going to end up posting this show maybe in early August because I want to take some time to edit it a little bit. So look forward to. I mean, if you're already listening to it, you know when it came out. But I guess I'm just talking to you at this point, Ryan.
if you're listening right now, maybe it sounds a little bit neater and tighter than it sounded as we're talking.
Yeah, I mean, send us an email. Let us know what the future is like. And what game do you want to do next?
Oh, well, we might have to come back and do Xenoblade X.
Okay. I'm all for that. I'm still playing. Yeah. Shoot me a Miiverse message or a Sky or, you know, whatever when you want to get around to it. Because I'm always down.
Sounds good.
But cool. That's a show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes. Peace.